IFPRI Policy Seminar, Transformation of Economies in Africa, held on Thursday, June 14, 2012, in Washington, D.C. Speaker, His Excellency John Kufuor, former President of the Republic of Ghana.
Good afternoon. Really, I didn't expect to be engaged in this very important conversation. I had come to Washington for a different purpose, but because of the friendship and commitment to Schengen, when I got conned that I should visit, I thought I was just coming to visit because the first time I'm coming to the Institute here. But now I find myself confronted with all of you and with a panel of excellence, the people I'm coming to discuss with. What I would say for beginning is that the real challenge of Africa is that it is caught up in a maelstrom of global very fast transformation. Whereas Europe became developed through first agricultural revolution before it moved on almost leisurely to industrial revolution, had time to stabilize and using science and technology and research, had time to hold leadership for a long time, building its institutions very firmly and strongly on the ground, equipping the people as individuals with enlightenment. And I believe the same can be said of the United States here. And Asia, with very ancient civilizations, literacy and numeracy being there for millennia. Africa, which a long history came to be caught up in challenges for decades, in fact centuries. If it's slave trade, if it's colonization, Africa just didn't get the opportunity to grow the way the other continents grew. Then, just within a period of 50 years, the past 50 years, Africa was thrown into self-government and independence and was made conscious of an international trade system in which it didn't take part, really. It was forced participation, and we took part through our European former governments. So we find that getting into the mainstream of the global transformation has become a bit nightmarish. Our political systems are not stabilized yet. So, to quote President Obama when he visited Ghana soon after his swearing in, he said, what Africa needed was strong institutions, not strong men. Meaning Africa was awash with strong men. And it's now Africa is untying itself from the strong men to build the institutions. But at the same time, the world is not waiting for us. We are forced to be part of the globalization process, especially on the economic front. Africa has everything in terms of natural resources, perhaps more than most of the other continents. But then, the exploitation of the resources, which demands high science, high research, technology. Africa is very much lagging in these necessities. The finance system, again, is a quarter where Africa lacks presence in. Then even the governance mechanisms, the strong men didn't give room to the private sector to grow. Any private entrepreneur showing signs of exceptional prowess is looked on as an enemy of the powers of the day, and such an entrepreneur becomes a victim. So what happens is the supposed partners that come into Africa to help develop the economy become exploiters. And Africa is not given the fair share. So these are the, I believe, the hurdles for Africa to jump to mainstream. The term that has been used aptly, I believe, is leapfrog. Africa must find ways and means to leapfrog the handicaps confronting it to get into the mainstream, side by side with Europe, with fast-growing Asia, the Americas, and it's a challenge. For Africa to cut through and succeed with a leapfrog, I believe the most critical factor is leadership. A leadership that would bring in the vision, with the knowledge of where the world is going, and also with the vision and understanding of the mechanisms to use to move the people, and also the ability of carrying the people along with it. Africa equipping itself with the knowledge, with the negotiating skills, because we can't avoid the partnerships. In fact, the African Union itself has decreed that for Africa to move forward, Africa needs partnerships. Partnerships that would bring the know-how, the capital, the markets to go. But to get see these partnerships, Africa must be able to negotiate, to secure its interests, even as it allows the partners also to make their legitimate profits and concerns that they've come to Africa with. This is the challenge Africa is facing. In Ghana's case, let me talk about the personal example I had. I became president of Ghana 2001, at a time when the economy had been declared HIPIC, highly indebted poor country, meaning it's like we were insolvent. We couldn't service our debts, so creditors were not looking at us. That's 2001. The GDP growth rate was 3.4 thereabouts. The expectations were high. Unemployment, the farmers. Ghana has for over 100 years before 2001 depended on cocoa. The farmers were getting disillusioned because the reward system wasn't operating to their favor. And without cocoa, that contributed at that time, I believe, more than 30% of the GDP. The economy was going to collapse. We had gold, but the ownership of the mines was almost exclusively in the hands of the foreign partners, with the state having no more than, say, 10% or so in the equity. So when my government was thus confronted, we looked around trying to secure help from perceived friends, donor community. Nobody would look at us. And the term of office is just 4 years. And we've gone democracy constitutionally. If you do not perform to the, is it a satisfaction of the electorate? 4 years, you are booted out. And now all politicians want to stay in power. So we had to look and look very fast. How do we turn things around to assure the people that if they would give us the opportunity, would move the country forward, transform it to meet the expectations? And so within the first 3 months, my government was forced with the unpleasant duty of admitting publicly that the country was virtually insolvent, declare for the highly indebted poor countries initiative. So the creditor partners, the donor community, the multilaterals, would free us from the burdens of having to service the loans, and also to forgive some of the loans. It wasn't a popular initiative we were forced to take. Even members of cabinet didn't agree that we should own up, that the country was so unserviceable. But we had to do it. Otherwise, our political prospects would be doomed. So that's how we took the HIPIC initiative, I think within the first quarter of 2001. Fortunately for us, immediately we declared it as policy to accept to work with the multilaterals and discipline the macroeconomy, cut down on the borrowing, government indiscriminate borrowing both domestically. And immediately we took this initiative, the creditor community started forgiving Ghana. 2001, the small economy with GDP of about 3 billion was saddled to find 250 million just to service the loans. On this initiative, all the creditor community wrote off our having to pay them that interest. That freed the government and immediately also arrested the attention of the nation that this government knew what it was about, and that the savings from the forgiveness could be used to give the social services like rural development, making the feeder roads, building health centers where the people needed them, potable water wells, and that sort of thing. That's how we started. But that initiative also impressed the partners that the government was the government to help, to do things. And with this freedom we got, our government launched a five-pronged priority policy. First was to pursue vigorous infrastructural development, open up the country, make the roads, build the energy plants, telecommunications, water supplies. So to create the atmosphere to attract investors that when they follow up, they may establish their businesses profitably. The other one was, again, to quickly modernize agriculture and commercialize it. Agriculture engaged over 60% of the population. 60% of Ghana's population lived on the land. We are small farmers. Cocoa, which has been the lifeblood to now, was what the colonial system engaged the people in. Fortunately, the British didn't use the big planters. They built cocoa on the small farmers, farming 3 acres, 5 acres, averagely. But then the farmers did their work so well, manually prepared the beans so well, that Ghana was famed as the country producing the highest quality beans in the world. In fact, till about the 1950s, Ghana was the number one producer of cocoa, high quality premium cocoa throughout the world, number one. Into the 50s and early 60s, because of the confused politics we fell into, Cote d'Ivoire, our neighbor, beat us. But Cote d'Ivoire approached the cocoa plantation on the plantation from, you know, I think, partnership with France, and so they built large plantations. And the individual small farmer didn't have the skills the Ghanaian farmer continued to have. And this was what supported us. So we said, if 60% of the people lived on the land this way, and we could improve the quality of life for them, then we would be really transforming the entire community. The farmer was losing interest by 2001. That year, the produce of cocoa was just 350,000 tons. But the farmers had started cutting down their cocoa to do oranges and other crops, thinking they would get more returns from these other crops. Our government decided we couldn't let cocoa die. That time, the international price, market price for the cocoa, was shared with the state taking 65% and leaving only 35% to the farmer and not helping the farmer much. Government, our government decided, look, give the farmer 65%, let the state take 35%. Additionally, because the farmer had supported the state for the previous 100 years or so, government should show appreciation by spraying their farms free of charge, the farmers free of charge at the expense of state with pesticides and also supporting the farmer with the fertilizer systems and using the extension services on the hybrid crop seedlings and so forth. So we launched this. And between 2002 and 2005, to our happiness, the crop jumped from 350,000 tons 2001 to over 700,000 tons, all-time record over the previous 100 years crop production. And then, with so much money in the hands of the farmer, the per capita income gained some impact right at the grassroots. And with that, government was able to even forecast that by 2010, Ghana would exceed the million ton crop per year. And Ghana has achieved it already. Ghana has already exceeded production of cocoa beans of over 1 million tons. And the prices are good. Fortunately, the world has taken to enjoying cocoa, and so the world price, the world market is also booming. And it's reflected on the per capita income, which used to be $350 that time. Currently, Ghana enjoys $1,300 plus per capita. And already Ghana is accepted as middle income, even by the multilaterals. And the rate of growth now is said to be one of the fastest in the whole world. Currently, it's about 13.5% to 14%. Fortunately, those times we were launching these policies to transform. We didn't have oil or gas. We had to import everything. By 2007, Ghana found its own oil fields. And the first find was again accepted to be the single biggest find in the whole of Africa for the previous 10 years. So now we see bright stars and gold ahead of Ghana. But underpinning all this, I believe, is the visionary public-private partnership that the government launched. Government didn't try to take the, cocoa away from the private farmer. Rather, it pushed the farmer to see the profitability and his venture, and also laid the policies, making the roads for the farmer, helping with the farming, marketing practices, the storage facilities. All these things have been heightened. And then we saw that the youth who used to drift en masse to the capitals looking for white-collar jobs couldn't be held or retained on the land, not until they saw profitability. So, what the integrated policy that we launched was to build good schools in the rural areas. For instance, we said for secondary schools, we are going to do what we called model secondary schools in every district of Ghana. At that time, the districts were about 170, so that the youth wouldn't need to come away from the rural parts to the urban areas where they few secondary schools were. And we launched this thing, and it's ongoing. Potable water was everywhere. Extension of electricity. We approached America, for instance, and using the Exim Bank and OPIC, we got a credit line of over $300 million to extend electricity to all the rural parts. Talked of potable water, health centers were launched everywhere. And then we wanted to the youth to see the profitability. We also introduced mechanization, because traditionally the old people used just the hoe and cutlass, which would leave the farm has screwed us a tortoise back. The young people with education didn't want to go that way. So employing mechanization of sorts, using tractors and other things, we thought might also help retain the youth, because they should be the future of agriculture. There's been a knock-on effect throughout the economy, attracting medium to large investors, like cocoa processors. Before, Ghana exported almost 100% of the beans to Europe, to America, for processing. As we speak, I believe companies like Cargill from the United States, ADM, who are leaders in processing of cocoa here, they are in Ghana, they built factories, big factories, to process. Cadbury, that used to be there colonial times and left, has come back. Nestle has brought its headquarters in West Africa to Ghana. They are all there. Barkalibo is also there. And we see that the know-how is coming, and they are engaging young Ghanaian, well-educated youth to work with. And I believe that's where the future is. And with oil and gas also now available, we foresee the industrialization that should couple the agricultural change to give quality of life across the board. But I'll go back and with government. Unless the government is seized with the vision of empowering the people and improving the quality of life of the people, not by sort of giving the people the fish, but getting the people to learn to fish for themselves, unless it happens like that, I'm afraid it will take some while. But then too, let me also talk of democratization. Government or political leaders should have a sense of limitation. They should know that they get the power constitutionally from the people, that the people are the sovereign authority. And not until they learn to respect the people in whom power resides and learn to play by the rules and become accountable and transparent with the people, a lot of whatever will be pursued for transformation may be rendered questionable. So this is my contribution. This is what we try to do for Ghana.
Well, thank you, Excellency, for your great speech. Just for your information, under President Kofo's leadership, Ghana is the only country in Africa that achieved both MDG 1 goals, cutting hunger and cutting poverty by half. So many African countries have achieved cutting hunger by half, but the poverty by half, but not hunger by half. So we should really congratulate you. It's a great work from Ghana. So I will ask you some more questions after two speakers' discussion. Chantal?